This is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today, we're talking with Jennifer Lawrence, who lives in Poulsbo and who has her newest book of poetry, Grayling, out from Perugia Press in 2015. Her first collection, 100 Steps from Shore, was from Blue Begonia. Her awards include Perugia's Press Prize, the Orlando Poetry Prize, the James Hirst Poetry Prize, Potomac Review's Poetry Award, and a Washington State Artist Trust Gap grant. Recent work appears in Los Angeles Review, Narrative, North American Review, Rattle, and elsewhere. She is an editor for Crab Creek Review. Welcome, Jennifer.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
I'm really glad to talk with you. Recently, just a few months ago, I heard you read from Grayling right here in Port Townsend at the North Wind Reading Series. And I went to look into your website, www.jenniferlawrence.net, and read some of the wonderful reviews of that book. I was really struck with the idea that you are including your childhood in Alaska in a lot of your poems, the images of coastline and snows, ices, tide pools, and the alcohol that was present in your childhood. I was wondering if you could speak to the title of your book, Grayling.
Yes. Well, the Arctic grayling is a kind of a fish that's found in the rivers near and outside of Valdez, where I spent a couple of years in my early childhood and where I learned to fish. And the grayling makes an appearance in several of the poems, or a few of the poems. And I guess I would have to say it's a representation of the intertwining of nature and human that seems to appear in my book a lot.
I have never heard of a grayling, and didn't even imagine it at first as a fish. I imagined it as some kind of a mammal.
Well, there's another kind of grayling that's not an Arctic grayling, but it is a fish that lives in other parts of the United States, I think in the lakes, Michigan and those parts. I might be wrong about that. But the Arctic grayling is the one I had in mind.
And did you read at the reading a poem that is called Grayling?
No, actually, I don't have a poem in the book titled Grayling, but it makes an appearance. And the first poem in the book mentions that. And I could read that now if you like.
That would be wonderful.
All right. It's titled, What Her Father Cast. He said, stand on your own 2 feet, and her shadow swam into a fish, spooled from her reel at the speed of grayling. He spoke the river's name, Consina, shade of a salmon's breath, flaring in the grizzly's mouth. She took off her clothes to hang from the side of the boat. Her legs refused to fuse into a tail, as planned. Kneel at the river's edge. If the father you love has been drinking again, cling, as sea lice cling to a salmon after death, then fall to the fire when the fish is cooked through. There goes her shadow again. There goes the reel.
Very vivid and very heartbreaking. Thank you. Before we go on, Jennifer, when I was reading your website address, I remembered that when I looked up your name online to find the website, I wrote your name, Jennifer, with 2 N's. And of course, I came up with the famous actress, Jennifer Lawrence. And I imagined myself asking you, what does that feel like? And what happens in your writing career when people look for you and find Jennifer Lawrence, or that you carry that name around now?
It's funny. I don't think that it affects my writing career in any way other than it might misdirect a few people who don't manage to find their way to my website. But in other ways, sometimes just in interactions with strangers, they'll address me as if I am that Jennifer Lawrence. And I walked into the hardware store, for instance, right after the Academy Awards last year, and I was on my way to get a toilet repair kit. And when I brought it up to the counter and set it on the counter, the clerk looked at my driver's license and said, oh, I loved that red dress you were wearing last night. Just said that directly to me. So, and that has happened in other places, always with strangers, usually with men, but not always. And it's just a funny little way of that person fulfilling some fantasy of theirs, I suspect.
Right.
Has little to do with me.
It's very entertaining. But I think it might be an occasion for a poem.
Maybe. I keep notes.
Yes, good. Thank you. In the poem that you read, the first poem in Grayling, it shows the way you fold the landscape, or in this case, waterscape, in with the behavior of people in your poetry. And I would think that might be for you one of the values of writing poetry, is this way of weaving surrounding with behavior. And I wondered if you could talk perhaps about what the value of writing poetry is for you in particular, but what you think of it in general too.
Oh, sure. I can do that. One of the things I wanted to say is that I don't have an intentional approach to including landscape and behaviors in together in my poems, but it just seems to happen over and over again and has sort of become my way of writing. I think it is just the strength of the influence of my semi-wild landscape of my childhood. In fact, even outside of poetry, I find myself comparing every landscape to the one in which I grew up. I live near the Hood Canal, and that looks a lot like the Gastineau Channel, which appears in my work and which I grew up next to. The Olympic Mountains remind me of the Wrangell Mountains in southeast Alaska. So I'm always comparing everything I see to Alaska and the landscapes that I grew up with. So, but as far as the value of poetry, it's, you know, that's a really difficult question. But I think poetry is a way of saying what is difficult to say in a way that couldn't be said otherwise. So that, for instance, you and I both write about grief and loss, and it's hard to bring those topics up in ordinary conversation, and some people find it impossible to talk about those things for their whole life. But in my early writing, in my first book, before this poem was published, I shared it with someone at the Port Townsend Writers Conference, and they wrote me a note to say that this poem had helped them to understand something that their mother had been carrying for over 30 years. Mm-hmm. So if I could just read a little excerpt. It's from a longer poem called Northern Lights Stop Shining. It's from 100 Steps from Shore. I'm just going to read a short stanza from it, and then I'll talk about it a little. 10 years after my sister's death, my husband ran over a 2-year-old boy. I was in Juneau visiting family when he called. I told her not to pick him up, but she did. He let go of his sister's hand. He was shorter than the truck. I didn't see him. They were waiting for the light. The light turned green, and I went. It almost tore his ear off. A lot of blood filled his sister's lap where they sat on the curb. I asked how the boy was now, how he was. He did not know the answer to either. Said the policeman recommended he not call the hospital, not apologize, because that would be admitting guilt. But how can I not? So that's just a little excerpt, but that second to last sentence there about the policeman recommending that no apology be made because that could be seen as an admission of guilt. Mm-hmm. That was the line that helped this woman understand her mother, who had lost a child over 30 years before, and the person that had caused that accidentally had never apologized. And for 30 years, the daughter had been listening to her mother say, well, why can't they just say they're sorry? Mm-hmm. And so finally she understood why maybe they never said they were sorry. And so she said for her, it was just really healing. And yeah, and so that line in this poem of mine that I didn't even know if it would get published had that effect on one family, mm-hmm, of bringing some healing. And so I think that poetry's value can be measured that individually. If it just helps one person somewhere, then it's worth it.
I agree with you 100%. And the part is, you never know really what line that will be, what image that will be, what poem that will be, but there's most likely somebody out there who's going to benefit from these words that, as a poet, you dig very deeply into yourself to find, to be able to say. Like you said, we don't usually talk about these things in life, and
exactly. We
do in poetry. And as Sam Hamill wrote, poetry is for saying the unsayable. It takes.
Yes, I knew that wasn't my own thought.
Well, no, but it is your own thought. The way you say it is your own thought. But it's like there are these ways of saying it that help us see that the work of a poet is meaningful, even if it's not highly remunerated, right, even if it's often so misunderstood, or people who say, oh, I don't understand poetry, I hate poetry. And I always like to tell people about poets that I know they're going to like, and also that, of course, we understand poetry. We might not want to understand what it's saying, but I think that if we feel what it's evoking, we understand poetry. And the excerpt you read is full of evocation of tragedy, all kinds of tragedy, layer and layer of tragedy. So when did you realize that you were a poet?
That happened really early, although it then faded for a while. I was 8 or 10, I think, and had written this poem that I was very proud of about a cutthroat trout. I've been writing about fish since long as I can remember, and I'm still doing it these days. But I wrote this poem. It was very full of rhymes and adjectives, and I mailed it off to Good Housekeeping magazine, which was one of two magazines that I was aware of existing at the time, because my parents subscribed to Good Housekeeping and National Geographic. And so I sent it off, and I thought, oh, they're going to publish this poem. It's just wonderful. I was really proud of it. And of course, I never heard back from them. But I wrote poetry from then all through my adolescence and in high school. But after that, I stopped. Just life got in the way, and I went a different direction, and I didn't take it up again until the late 90s. But since then, I've been writing nonstop, pretty much.
So do you know what compelled you to start again in the late 90s?
I would have to say that it was major life changes. I had been through a divorce. My children were getting older and had a lot of crises, and I started writing again, I think, just as a way of exploring what was going on in my life and trying to make sense of things.
Right. Poetry is often the very best conversation we can have with ourselves and with others.
Yes.
Another value of it. So what did you do at that point? Did you connect with other poets or communities of poetry in some way?
What I did at that point actually was sign up for a one-day workshop at Fort Worden with the poet David Lee, who was at the summer writing conference that in 2000, I think it was. And I got brave enough to share my poem with a circle of poets there at the table, and I was just terrified. But the response that I got, and it was not a good poem, but the response that I got was so warm and welcoming and encouraging that I practically leapt up from my chair and to say, this is what I want to do with my life. And it was, I have not looked back from that moment. So I enrolled in the Port Townsend Writers Conference year after year for my poetry education, because my career is in civil engineering.
Oh.
So kind of the opposite of poetry. Although, I don't know, some engineers are very poetic.
Of course. And do you find that as much as you use fishing in the Alaska landscape, do you think that you use civil engineering terms at all?
No, hardly ever. Hardly ever. Sometimes the terminology finds its way in.
Such as things like?
Let's see. Survey instruments that you measure the ground with. You know, there's types of soil that you have to analyze to see if stormwater runoff will infiltrate into it, things like that.
So,
but not the people so much.
Yeah, but when you have an education in something that's so rich with information, it seems very likely that it would be useful in writing poetry. Just hearing you list off those images.
It probably does influence me more than I am aware of. I'll try and look through my work and see if that's the case.
Yeah, it gives you a whole vocabulary, a way of articulating things. I didn't know that was in your background. I know you as a poet.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 Port Townsend. In case you've just joined us, you're listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Today, Sheila is talking with Paul's Bow poet, Jennifer Lawrence, about the inspirations for her poetry, including her experience with the Alaskan landscape.
So, who were the poets that you studied with, or who you read, who you think are your influences?
Oh, well, early on, I joined this writing group that was just forming on Bainbridge Island. There's this wonderful little poetry workshop run by John Wilson, who lives on Bainbridge Island. And I met a woman there who was interested in starting her own group, and we did. That's Janet Norman Knox. She's a great poet as well. And she and Kelly Russell Agadon and Annette Spalding Convey and some others formed a writing group. And that was, gosh, I think it's been at least 14 years ago. And even though we don't meet very often anymore, their influence really helped me grow as a poet. And you may know Kelly Agadon and Annette Spaulding Convy as two Northwest poets who have, a couple of years ago, formed Independent Press. That's Two Sylvias Press, which is wonderful. And they've published a lot of books between them. They've been a big influence on me. And contemporary poets at the Writers Conference have had a big influence on me as well. The poet Joseph Stroud, mm-hmm. who is he lives in Santa Cruz, California. He came up and taught at the Summer Writing Conference in 2003, and I was lucky enough to be in his class. And he really transformed the way I thought about writing. He had us writing every day, focusing on observation. He sent us out to look at things and report back with very little other direction. And I think that was the beginning of my really close focusing on the world in front of me. And
how did you do it before?
Entered into my work. Very haphazardly. I would just start. I did a lot of free writing. In fact, I still do that. That's where you just give yourself a little writing prompt. And I still use a pen and paper and just scribble for a prescribed amount of time as pretty much as fast as you can without trying to edit any words as you go. And then you go back and you see if there's any little gems in there that you can work from. But I didn't have any focused notion of how to make a poem stronger or better. It takes a long time to figure those things out. Mm-hmm. But that year in Joseph Stroud's class was transformative for me. And others I've studied with there at the Port Townsend Writers Conference, Kim Adonisio, Dorianne Locks, Marvin Bell, who I just loved. You know, I really love Lucille Clifton. I got to hear her read once a few years ago before she passed away, and that was wonderful. I like her short poems that are just so packed with emotion and story and real life in everyday language. I just love that mm-hmm. about the work.
This might be, if you'd like to, a time to read one of your own short poems. Because you do the same thing. You pack quite a bit into a few lines. Do you have one you might read to us?
Let's see here. Well, here's a poem about, there's a section of work in Grayling that is about childbirth and infertility and miscarriage, loss having to do with reproduction, I guess. And this poem is called The Last Dog That Died Unburied Herself. The last dog that died unburied herself and ghosted the silver planks of this porch while hornets fought over her blood. Today, mason bees mud up their surrogate wombs. The hornet at the window wants the sky full of arrows, a fingerprint whorl scorched on its thorax. Thistles poke between the boards, rotted gaps we line with rags, covering the stretch marks of a house bound up in sorrow. At dusk, we watch the dying moths in yellow light. Goodnight, sparrows settle in the branches. In the middle of the bed, a kestrel intercepts your dream, straps a parachute to your child's back, and pushes him from the house.
Well, I see your observational powers at work, noticing all of those insects among the larger bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Thank mm-hmm. you. Thank you. And I didn't mean to interrupt you when you were talking about Lucille Clifton, and then you were talking about a few other people that you admire and have learned from.
Oh, yes. Well, I think that was about it.
So yeah, you could probably go on and on. Yeah, thank you. And what a treasure having the Port Townsend Writers Conference here each summer. And you certainly speak well to the fact that those of us living nearby and wanting to write would get a lot out of going and going.
Oh, I recommend it highly, yes.
Yeah. So now that you've switched from, it sounds like, being a civil engineer, are you still working as a civil engineer?
I am. Ah. I still work as a civil engineer. So I have a 32-hour work week as a civil engineer. And then I am editing, I'm Crab Creek Review, as you know, uh-huh. and trying to do my writing and take care of family and
all those things. So you have what most of us would call a kind of normal everyday life, and yet I'm interested to know if you think poets live differently in the world.
I think that they do in the way that all artists do in this, maybe it's an obsession to observe and report on the world in whatever form that takes. I find myself when I'm in a tough situation emotionally, before I'm even through it, I'm already thinking about how I might make sense of it by writing through it. Mm-hmm. And I think other types of artists probably do the same thing, whether you're a sculptor or a painter, a prose writer.
It's always with you.
Yeah. It's always with us. Yes.
You know, as you're talking, I'm remembering a gig I had years ago now at a high school, being a poet in the schools. And I was teaching metaphor, and a student said to me, "Oh, I can think like that, but when I do, I get in trouble with all my teachers." And the memory of that has never left me, because going along with that then is a memory of an adult student who had brought the class to tears, or had responded in tears to somebody else's writing. Through her sobs, she said, "Oh, why can't life be like this every day?" And I remember saying, "Well, how could we go to the bank and pump gas?" And everybody laughed, and we went on to consider more poems. But what is it like to be an engineer and a poet, to be someone concerned with daily life and a poet? I mean, the poetry is always with you, and how do we operate at both levels? I mean, I know it's a deep question, but if anything occurs to you.
It is a deep question. So I guess I've kind of switched modes. When I'm at work, I need to be left-brained and goal-oriented. I enjoy my work. It's interesting, and it's creative moments. Engineers have to design bridges and buildings and shopping malls, all that will function properly, you know, and so there's a lot of arts that goes into that too, I think. But you know, on the review side, which is what I do, I have to pay attention to codes and regulations. So I think I just kind of switch off the creative mode, the poet mode, and turn on the engineer mode until I'm off work.
Yeah. So maybe that's something we learn to do as we get older, and the young student in high school didn't have the switch yet.
Right. I would think that would be very true.
Yeah.
And maybe some people don't have a switch. I can't imagine teaching poetry for a living. I don't know that I'd be that effective as a teacher. But I wonder how that would be different if you taught poetry all day and then to come home and try and write your own poetry. I don't know if the switch stays on or if there's still this disconnect.
Right.
I don't
well,
know how that would be.
I think one of the things that's true in my life as a teacher is that I enjoy exercising that writing muscle so much, whether it's other people's work or my own, that sometimes I am so satisfied having worked with them that I don't sit down and write my own, and then I'm upset with myself. So it's interesting being a poet in the world and teaching and writing, or designing or reviewing codes and writing. There's a place for it all, but it definitely, there are sacrifices involved. And I'm really excited by you saying that you decided to write and not turn back from that decision. So do you have another poem to read to us, perhaps?
So that's one thing that poets like to do, right, is to read their work to us.
Absolutely.
This is a poem about the death of my sister, who died in a car accident when she and I were both teenagers. It's titled, "In the House on Gastineau Channel." My sister ironed her dress on a bath towel laid over the walnut table. Heat lifted the varnish and shaped a milk cloud of a missing girl. November tides flushed blue clay and cobbles from beneath the deck, salt water freezing to creosote pilings like pitch. Curly, dark-haired dog, a salmon catcher with a retriever's soft mouth, and she, third from our mother's womb. The baneberry grew like a prophet. Behind the outhouse, we nailed siding in a Sitka spruce, a platform big enough for a sleeping bag and book. Above us, scolding, the red squirrel with a turquoise tumor like a jewel piercing its eyelid.
Thank you. It is so hard to write about grief, and it is so hard to feel as a writer, poet, that we have any words to express the loss that even amount to anything near that loss. So I admire your poem, and I admire your courage for writing it and the desire to write it that compelled you to. So thank you for sharing that particular one.
Thank you.
Our time is growing a little short, and I would really like you to speak, if you can, to the question of, what do you say to people who say they are afraid of poetry or that they don't understand it?
I have not had anybody tell me they were afraid of poetry. I've had them tell me they hate poetry when I tell them that.
Okay. What do you say?
And that they don't understand it. I am sometimes at a loss for words when people say that to me. But I do try to explain that there are so many different kinds of poetry, and that if they hate poetry, it's entirely possible that they just haven't found the right poem yet, and also that there is some knowledge required to understand poetry in some ways. And then I suggest maybe some poets for them to read. Mary Oliver is one that comes up high on my list. Mm-hmm. I have a friend that says she hates poetry, but she's been to several of my poetry readings.
And then what does she say?
I appreciate that. She says that she enjoys my work. In fact, I have another friend, a man who also does not like poetry, but he said that my work makes him rethink that because he appreciates poetry that tells a story with the emotion present also, and that is not so experimental. I think that's the trouble that he has is with experimental poetry and in general.
I enjoy those stories, Jennifer, and it makes me think that one thing we can do just as poets is have friends come to our readings and tell us.
I agree. And I am so grateful for all my friends that come to my readings.
Yes. Well, I am grateful for our conversation, and our time is drawing to a close. I just want to thank you again for being with us, and I am going to be reading more of your poems, and I am going to be thinking a lot about landscape and poetry. So thank you so very much.
Thank you, Sheila. It was my pleasure.
You have been listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life with Sheila Bender. For more of Sheila's interviews, please go to Sheila's website, writingitreal.com/audio. In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Announcer is Kurt Vanderslice.